with Iran. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Iran has held a funeral ceremony for its top nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who was assassinated near Tehran on Friday. Due to coronavirus, only senior government and military officials attended the event. Addressing the participants, Iranian Defense Minister Amir Khatami said assassinating Iranian scientists is an indication of the enemy's defeat. The defense minister vowed a crushing response to the perpetrators of the attack.
Every criminal activity, every assassination or terror will be responded. The enemies must know that they will receive a crushing response and that we will act in accordance with the order of Iran's leader, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei.
Fakhrizadeh, who headed the Iranian Defense Minister's Organization of Defensive Innovation and Research, was assassinated after his car was ambushed in the city of Absert, east of the capital Tehran. Fakhrizadeh was seriously injured and taken to hospital, but he succumbed to his wounds. He had a long history in defense innovations and had made key efforts to promote Iran's peaceful nuclear energy program. This made him the number one target of Israel's intelligence services, which have a track record of targeted killings of Iranian nuclear scientists nearly a decade ago.
History has shown that the actions of the enemies will not be left unanswered. We will take revenge. We will punish all those who ordered and those who carried out this terrorist attack.
The main perpetrators of these terrorist attacks against my father should wake up to this reality that this path will continue and his blood will make his name remain in history for good. They can do nothing.
Observers say the assassination of the Iranian scientist comes as part of Israel's attempts to disrupt Iran's peaceful nuclear energy program, which Tel Aviv accuses of having military dimensions. Iran has time and again dismissed such allegations and signed the 2015 nuclear deal with the world powers as a sign of goodwill. Iranian officials have vowed a crushing response to the main perpetrators of the attack against Dr. Fakhrizadeh, saying his path will continue much more resolutely than ever before. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
In the limelight.
A former head of U.S. election security who said Donald Trump's defeat by Joe Biden was not subject to voter fraud should be taken out at dawn and shot, a Trump campaign lawyer has said. Condemnation of Trump campaign lawyer Joe DiGenova's remarks about Chris Krebs was swift, including calls for his disbarment and the charge of he was behaving like a mob attorney. Chris Krebs was fired as head of the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency CISO on 17th of November, not long after he said the election, contrary to Donald Trump's claims, was the most secure in American history. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Martin Pengelly. The piece is titled, Trump Lawyer, Ex-Election Security Chief Krebs should be taken out and shot. Stay with us for more of Martin Pengelly's article. Former head of U.S. election security who said Donald Trump's defeat by Joe Biden was not subject to voter fraud should be taken out at dawn and shot, a Trump campaign lawyer, Joe DiGenova, has said. Condemnation of Joe DiGenova's remarks about Chris Krebs was swift, including calls for his debarment and the charge that he was behaving like a mob attorney. Chris Krebs was fired as head of the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency CISO on 17th of November, not long after he said the election, contrary to what Donald Trump has claimed, was the most secure in American history. Chris Krebs also used Twitter to publicly debunk Donald Trump's conspiracy theories. Di Genoa defended the president in the Russia investigation and is now involved in attempts to overturn results in battleground states. The Trump campaign has won one lawsuit and lost 39 others. Di Genoa made the remark about Chris Krebs on the Howie Carr Show, a podcast shown on YouTube and Trump-allied Newsmax TV, on Monday, 30th of November. Anybody who thinks the election went well, he said, like that idiot Krebs, who used to be the head of cybersecurity, that guy is a Class A moron. He should be drawn and quartered, taken out at dawn and shot. Howie Carr did not challenge the remark on his television show. A day earlier, Chris Krebs told CBS's 60 Minutes program, Trump was trying to undermine democracy, to undermine confidence in the election, to confuse people, to scare people. Donald Trump called the interview ridiculous, one-sided, and an international joke. Di Genoa is not the first close Trump aide to call for the death of an official in the president's disfavor. In early November, former campaign chief and White House strategist Steve Bannon said FBI Director Christopher Wray and public health expert Anthony Fauci should be beheaded. He was banned from Twitter for that remark. Joe DiGenova said Donald Trump's legal team was talking to the jury, trying to influence the jury, and that includes judges and state legislatures, and the governors in these states are a bunch of losers, along with their secretaries of state. I've never seen such wimps wearing a Republican badge. You know, they're going to have to be dealt with politically. It's the only way you deal with these people. Brad Raffensperger, the Republican Secretary of State in Georgia, who has resisted attempts to overturn Joe Biden's win there, has said he and his wife have received death threats from Donald Trump supporters. Condemnation of Joe DiGenova's remarks about Chris Krebs was swift. Lois Clark, chief executive of the Government Accountability Project, said in a statement, "Threats like these trigger an avalanche of them. They terrorize other whistleblowers into silence. Its behavior befitting a mob attorney." Frank Figliuzzi, a former FBI deputy director, said Joe DiGenova had made a retaliatory threat against Chris Krebs' official duties in violation of federal law Title 18 U.S.C. 351. Andrew Weissman, a former federal prosecutor and senior aide to special counsel Robert Mueller in the Russia investigation, tweeted that the remark was shocking and that Joe DiGenova should face disbarment at least. Chris Krebs, he said, had shown fearless integrity.
In May 2017, Saudi Arabia established a so-called counter-extremism center with much fanfare. The so-called Global Center to Combat Extremism, GCCE, was officially inaugurated by Saudi King Salman bin Abdulaziz Al Saud in the presence of U.S. President Donald Trump at an ostentatious ceremony in Riyadh. The center's founding secretary general, Nasir al-Bighami, described its core mission as the fruit of collaboration between Muslim countries that believe in the importance of combating terrorism. But is that so? According to informed sources, the GCCE employs around 10,000 staff, each of whom are tasked with operating 100 fake social media accounts. According to the same sources, the GCCE is fully coordinated with a specialized unit in the Saudi Arabian Defense Ministry, known as the Soft Warfare Center, which is under the direct control of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. The founding of the GCCE was quickly followed by the establishment of the Prince Khalid Al Faisal Center for Moderation 4 months later in September 2017. The so-called Moderation Center was officially inaugurated by Prince Khalid Al Faisal, the governor of the Mecca region, in an ostentatious ceremony in Jeddah. The opening of the two centers, ostensibly designed to counter extremism, raised eyebrows across the international community. After all, Saudi Arabia is hardly a moderate country when it comes to religious and ideological affairs. Moreover, Saudi Arabia has decades-long form in institutionalizing hatred and extremism through the establishment of religious and ideological organizations with global reach. Two long-established organizations in particular, namely the Muslim World League, established in 1962, and the World Assembly of Muslim Youth, established in 1972, have been consistently and credibly accused of spreading Saudi Arabia's Wahhabi ideology across the world. Based on this history and track record, can Saudi Arabia be expected to suddenly and radically change course and institutionalize moderation and counter-extremism instead?
What is really going on with the center is completely the opposite of combating terrorism or extremism. And this is proved by the activities of the center, which is funded by billions of dollars from the Saudi budget.
The GCCE claims that it monitors and analyzes extremist content across the internet, and that it will in due course develop artificial intelligence technology to reach the roots of extremist ideologies. But its track record in the past 2.5 years suggests an entirely different goal, and one that is entirely in keeping with the harsh ideology and policies of the Saudi state. The GCCE, in fact, operates within a clear policy framework, and at the most basic level, its work is divided into domestic and foreign policy spheres. At the domestic level, the GCCE is predictably being used to identify and track dissent. To that end, there are credible reports that the center is being used to identify and track dissident bloggers. Because of the totalitarian nature of Saudi society, where there is no space whatsoever for dissent and opposition, social media, and in particular Twitter, have emerged as quasi-town squares where dissents can connect and talk. The center is also used to modify and improve the kingdom's image. It achieves this aim principally through the creation of hashtags and trends on Twitter. To that end, the center has focused much of its Twitter-based activity on improving the image of the kingdom's all-powerful crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman. It was the GCCE that created and sustained the hashtag trend Kullana Thaghafi Mohammed bin Salman, We All Believe in Mohammed bin Salman, in order to improve the prince's terrible reputation, especially in the wake of the gruesome murder of the dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in October 2018.
Because of the Saudi killings inside the country, beheadings, torture, the completely crash of opposition, and never forget the genocidal war against Yemen. And inside some of the Western countries, even in the United States, they were developing some kind of opposition against arming this terrorist regime to the teeth.
Interestingly enough, earlier this summer, the American social media influencer Aggie Lau was hired to tour Saudi Arabia in a desperate attempt by the kingdom to improve its image in the West. In the foreign policy sphere, the GCCE is being used to target countries and movements that are at odds with Saudi Arabia's goals and positions, both in the region and beyond. The recent protests and unrest in Lebanon and Iraq are a prime example in which the GCCE, in tandem with other Saudi security and psychological warfare organizations, has tried to influence the outcome of events. Reliable sources have told underreported that the GCC played a key role in raising the profile of the Iraqi protests on social media and in the process tried to depict the protests in a radicalized form. The GCC's role in the Iraq protests is in keeping with the kingdom's overall policy in Iraq, which is mostly focused on countering Iran's deeply entrenched and natural influence in the Shia-majority country. One of the key hashtags driving the unrest in Iraq, Al-Araq Yantafiz, Iraq Arise, has been linked to Saudi Arabia, as 79% of the accounts which have used that hashtag originate from the kingdom. It has also been reported that the Saudis have used 200 Twitter bots to energize the hashtag and help spread it across the length and breadth of the Twitter sphere. By contrast, only 6% of the tweets using the same hashtag actually originated from Iraq.
Apart from the direct support is the propaganda, the development, the trying to develop so-called color revolutions. For this, they have, apart from the Western intelligence services, apart from the Zionist Mossad, they have special advisors hired for money, US dollars.
The Saudis used a similar form of social media manipulation during a sudden bout of unrest and rioting in Iran in late December 2017 and early January 2018. At the time, the hashtag Yahdath al-An fi Iran, happened right now in Iran, became a major trend on Twitter, and subsequent investigations revealed that most of the tweets associated with the hashtag originated from Saudi Arabia. Taking a cue from the kingdom, and specifically the GCC, the terrorist cult, Mujahideen-e-Khalq organization, has created a troll farm, staffed by 1,000 cult members at its main base in Albania.
And of course, they're supporting terrorist groups and organizations who are very evil in mind and in activities against Iran, like the MKO, the so-called Mujahideen, like forces, similar forces from who are based in Pakistan, who are responsible for terror, for atrocities, etc.
Indeed, the Saudis have been harnessing the skills and experience accumulated in recent years to create veritable troll armies operating from troll farms in Riyadh and other locations in the kingdom. The New York Times reported in October 2018 that troll armies have been deployed against Saudi dissidents and that the late dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi had been contributing to efforts at countering these troll armies. The New York Times revealed that the Saudis employed a mole inside Twitter to further their spying, harassment, and media manipulation activities on social media platforms. A year later, the U.S. Justice Department charged two former Twitter employees with spying for Saudi Arabia. The two employees had accessed Twitter's information on Saudi dissidents using the social media platform. This is the first time that U.S. federal prosecutors have accused Saudi Arabia of running espionage operations in the United States. This developing case demonstrates the extent to which Saudi media manipulation has advanced in recent years. In the space of just a few years, the Saudis have gone from organizing run-of-the-mill troll farms to penetrating the very heart of Twitter itself. The role of the GCC in developing this expertise and gaining access to the heart of social media giants like Twitter is as yet unknown. But what is increasingly clear is that Saudi Arabia has transformed social media from a threat to an advantage in terms of using it to monitor and intimidate its critics abroad. By the same token, Saudi Arabia uses aggressive social media intimidation and disinformation campaigns to counter its regional rivals. So much for moderation and countering extremism.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Thank you.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Muhammad is my guide, Muhammad is my teacher, Muhammad my beloved Rasulullah.
I want to be like you.
Like you.
In everything I do, Ya Rasulullah.
I want to walk like you, talk like you, read my Quran just like you.
And we have not sent you, but as a mercy to the world.
I want to be a servant of God like Muhammad.
Be like Muhammad, live like Muhammad, see like Muhammad did. Muhammad, Rasulullah.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, I send my peace greetings to all of you, dear brothers and sisters, all around the globe. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to another program of Like Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wa alihi in IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Sayyid Wahid Alawi, and we are talking about different narrations that has to do with the salah, the prayers of the Prophet, and the way he conducted those prayers. And it is from the book Sunan al-Nabi, from the esteemed scholar Allama Tabatabai rahmatullah alayh. In a narration in the book of Al-Majma' of Al-Tabarsi, which narrates from Jabir ibn Samura, I did not see the noble Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayh delivering a sermon, but that he would do so while standing. Whoever tells you that he delivered sermons while sitting, know that he is lying. The Prophet, in other words, never ever sat down when he did a sermon. He was always standing. And that is the established sunnah of the Prophet, which all the denominations do. I cannot recall any denomination who recites a sermon while sitting down. In the Majma'ul Bayan, in his narration, Anas ibn Malik said, the noble Prophet used to offer the sacrifice of Adha, the Eid al-Adha, the Eid of sacrifice, before praying. So he used to offer the sacrifice of a sheep, of a cow, of a camel. There are different animals that you can sacrifice on the Eid of sacrifice, Adha, before praying. So before he used to recite the Eid prayers, he would have done the sacrifice. So he was commanded by Allah to pray first, then offer the sacrifice. So before he was commanded by Allah, he used to offer the sacrifice and then go towards the prayer. But that changed with the command by Allah, and he started to offer the prayers first and then do the sacrifice in Eid al-Adha. In another narration in the book of Al-Ikhtisas, when the noble Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi delivered a sermon, in the end he would say, paradise is for the one whose character is good, whose nature is pure, whose deeds performed in secret are pious whose actions performed in the open are virtuous, who gives away the best of his wealth in charity, who abstains from useless talk, and who treats the people fairly. Here you have 7 to 8 recommendations of how to behave and how to treat people. And this single sentence, this single prayers of the prophet, at the end of his sermons, tells us a lot and is sufficient for us for behaving good towards others and rectifying our characters. He says that paradise is for the one whose character is good, whose nature is pure, whose deeds performed in secret are pious, whose actions performed in the open are virtuous. So when you do something good, you don't need to talk about that thing. You don't need to tell anyone about that thing. You have done it in secret. Or if you do something openly, it should be virtuous. You should do it without blaming that person, without pressuring that person, without wanting something from that person. You do it virtuously. You do it as a good act. And who gives away the best of his wealth in charity. Usually when we want to give something to charity, we might give some things that we, first of all, do not need. Secondly, we give the worst of those things. The most destroyed tool, toy, device, the one who has some issues, that's the one, the most ugliest one, the most filthiest one, that's the one which we might give as charity. But here he says that who gives away the best of his wealth in charity. And do recall Fatima al-Zahra salamullah alayha, when she gave her wedding dress to a poor person, or when she gave away her necklace to a poor person. And that was most surely the best things that she had.
Oh, my one true love taught me to never judge. Now all I want is to be with you.
صلي على سيدنا مصطفى على حبيبك نبيك مصطفى اللهم صلي على سيدنا مصطفى على حبيبك نبيك مصطفى.
And the prophet continues here in this narration and says, who abstains from useless talk. Useless talk. Don't be talkative. Don't talk useless stuff. You spend hours and hours in gatherings of friends and talk about nonsense. No knowledge has been increased. And God forbid, sometimes we have even backbited someone. We have talked bad about someone behind that person's back. And that just continues with useless talk. And we have spent hours of our life not increasing our knowledge, but talking about useless stuff. So when you want to talk in gatherings, dear brothers and sisters, try to have topics that you can increase your knowledge in. Have topics that are not useless, but are actually useful for you. And the prophet continues and says, and who treats the people fairly. Treat people fairly. Treat them with justice. If you are a tradesman, if you are a trader, if you are in a shop, you should treat people fairly. If there are no fixed prices, you shouldn't give a price which is very, very, very high. But you should treat people fairly. Give them the fair price. Be fair towards people. Don't judge people unfairly. You know, sometimes you might help someone and you want something back from that person. Or you might treat someone unfairly in your job or in the school or between classmates. And that is something you should have in mind. Always treat people fairly. In another narration, dear brothers and sisters, which is from Imam Ali al-Ridha alayhi salam, and it comes from different chains of narrators, it goes back to al-Ridha alayhi salam, who says in his letter to Ma'mun, the Abbasid Khalifa, he says to Ma'mun, reciting Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim audibly with a loud voice in all the prayers is from the Sunnah of the Prophet. So when you recite Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim audibly, both in the obligatory prayers and in the recommended prayers, you have established and revived the Sunnah of the Prophet. Today, we have exactly the opposite in some denominations. We do not hear them saying Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, but they go straight to Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen, for example. And in the next chapter, they do the same. They start from the middle of the chapters of the Quran. And here we clearly see, and that is stated from Imam Ali al-Ridha, from one of the descendants of the Prophet, one of the immaculate Imams, who says that reciting Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim audibly in all the prayers is from the Sunnah. And that is something that we should reflect on if we do not act according to the Sunnah. In another narration in Majma'ul Bayan from Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, who said, when this chapter, Al-Kawthar, was revealed, the noble Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi asked Jibreel, what is the sacrifice that my Lord has asked of me? He said, it is not a sacrifice. Rather, he is commanding you to raise your hands when you commence the prayer as you recite the takbir. And again, when you go into ruku' and when you raise your head from the ruku' and when you go into sajda, for this is our prayer and the prayer of the angels in the seven heavens. Surely there is a beautification for everything, and the beautification for the salah is raising the hands with the recitation of every takbir. Basically, to sum it up, this long hadith is that whenever you say Allahu Akbar, whenever you reach the part where you say Allahu Akbar in the prayers, you raise your hands. Till next time, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon all of you.
Be like Muhammad, live like Muhammad, see like Muhammad did. Be like Muhammad and live like Muhammad and give like Muhammad gave. Shafi'ullah, Habibullah, Nabiullah, Rasulullah, Khalilullah, the friend of Allah, ya Rasulullah, Rasulullah.
Today.
He was not the first Iranian scientist to be assassinated in the past decade, but he was a pillar of Iran's scientific development and services for military and even medical purposes. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was ambushed in a weekend mountainous resort off Tehran on Friday, the 7th of November. Drag America into an unnecessary war and get it to set the rest of West Asia ablaze, too. And why? Just to hold on to your own illegitimate existence. It's not proven, of course, that said scientist was assassinated by Israel. But the evidence is tangible, and the motive no secret. But why now? And will it have been worth the effort? For answers, stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today. It's probable that Trump will be a single-term president, and if Biden takes office in the coming months, as it is assumed by his campaign slogans, he might return to the Iran nuclear deal and try to make U.S.'s approach different to that of Trump's and pick up talks with Iran. Now, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu has said loud and clear there must be no return to the previous nuclear agreement. What better motive for killing off Iran's elites and military scientists, especially with America on your side? Kill him off, provoke Iran, get America to counter-react, and there go any hopes for talks. Mr. Ruivaran is a Middle East analyst, always with historic detail handy to support his comments. Let's hear him out. The goal behind the assassination of yet another prominent Iranian scientist seems pretty straightforward. But what would you say it is?
In my opinion, there are two goals behind this assassination. It's a general goal that those seeking to restrict Iran's military industry have stepped in to turn their demands into an operational stage and thus assassinate the father of Iran's military industry. This has been a large-scale goal. The name of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh has already been mentioned by the Mossad and the CIA. The second goal was tactical. They seek to force Iran to make a rash reaction to this event. Basically, Mr. Trump is working with Israel to make Iran do something that would make it fundamentally impossible to return to the deal and prevent a possible Biden administration from returning to the deal.
President Trump has been using his first term's last days to impose a new sanction a week on Iran. That is just to make it all that much harder for a possible Biden administration to return to normalcy with this country. But be ready for an unexpected spin to the true story. Mr. Izadi here is professor of international studies.
I think Mr. Netanyahu is trying to do a favor for President-elect Biden. You know, they know each other for many years. Netanyahu calls Mr. Biden an old friend and part of his family. And what they are trying to do is to create a setting for when Biden becomes president to have leverage against Iran.
So Israel is aiming to help the U.S. bring a weakened Iran to the negotiating table. But what if they get more than they've asked for? Because attacking a fifth and sixth scientist on Iranian soil could provoke an Iranian attack on Israel, hence inviting U.S. intervention in the region yet again. Iran has promised retaliation. It has retaliated in the past against the U.S. Israel should be a lot easier. It's to be seen how and when Iran might do so, so as not to play into foul hands, however. Mr. Tajik joined us by Skype. To hear his experienced views is worth every moment of struggling with the connection.
With such moves, they try to force Iran to react. The next goal is to make Iran play into this scenario of the Zionist regime in Saudi Arabia and the Hebrew Arab faction. This will not happen. And naturally, the Islamic Republic will not set goals and actions based on the scenarios designed by others, but will act on its own plans to achieve its goals.
It is noteworthy that Iranian Parliament's first legal reaction to the assassination was to change the strategic action for lifting of sanctions, single urgency motion to double urgency motion, with an absolute majority of votes on November the 29th, 2020, in order to speed up action. The motion had been presented earlier and was passed on Tuesday, December the 1st, with 248 yeas. The motion has 9 provisions. Some important provisions are that the Nuclear Energy Organization must produce and store 120 kilograms of 20% enriched uranium annually, must produce 500 kilograms of uranium at different levels of enrichment for peaceful purposes once a month, and must reverse the Arak reactor back to its pre-JCPOA condition. Also, the government is obligated to report in 3 months from the passing of this motion on the compliance of other parties to the JCPOA. Should results not be satisfactory, the government must halt practice of the additional protocol of the NPT. Ms. Fallahi of the Parliamentary National Security Committee explains further.
Regarding this double agency motion, I should say that we didn't propose it in Parliament under despair of the moment. We had prepared it some 3 months ago, way before the assassination, as a reaction to the non-compliance of the 4+1 countries. It was approved as a single agency motion. Then after this unfortunate occurrence, we approved it as a double agency motion to expand our nuclear scientific capabilities. It is completely peaceful and in full compliance with the JCPOA's Articles 36 and 37, which state, should other parties to the deal not fulfill their commitments, we can also reduce our commitments as long as they have not returned to compliance. It is based on what those countries signed themselves.
The website Israel Hayom published a bold headline 29th November that read, Iran's tough year makes the world a safer place. It refers to the assassinations of Qasem Soleimani and Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, both recognized as martyrs in Iran. Such headlines coming from Israel sound like confessions, especially because Benjamin Netanyahu in April 2018 did say, remember this name, referring to Fakhrizadeh, as if putting a target on the scientist's back. For a glimpse into the more credible accounts of how the crime actually happened, we've got Mr. Abedin here with us in the studio. Mohan Abedin is a political analyst for Press TV. Welcome to the studio. Thanks for joining the program. Do feel free to begin your account whenever.
On the morning of Friday, 30th of November, one of Iran's leading scientists and a pioneer in nuclear-related research was transiting through the mountain retreat of Absad, situated nearly 100 kilometers east of the capital city, Tehran. While there are several versions as to what precisely unfolded on the main boulevard of Absad on that fateful morning, the following account is the most credible. As Dr. Fakhrizadeh's car was driving down the boulevard, his car came under attack from gunmen mounted on two motorcycles moving in the opposite direction of the leading scientist's car. As the gunmen on motorcycles approached Dr. Fakhrizadeh's car, they opened fire. Meanwhile, a semi-truck parked on the side of the road on Fakhrizadeh's side and packed with wood suddenly exploded. But the explosion was not as strong or effective as the assassins hoped. However, the explosion forced Dr. Fakhrizadeh out of his car, where he was struck by at least three bullets. One of Fakhrizadeh's bodyguards, possibly traveling on a trailing vehicle, tried to shield the leading scientist, and he too was hit by bullets and gravely wounded. Following a short outburst of gunfire, the terrorists quickly fled the scene by traveling down the boulevard and exiting Absad. Contrary to reports, the terrorists had not turned off the small town's electricity supply prior to the attack. The explosion of a semi-truck knocked off the town's power for a brief period. Again, contrary to reports, there were no CCTVs in the vicinity of the attack for the terrorists to deactivate. The closest CCTV is in a square where the town's municipality is situated, and that's several kilometers away from the scene of the attack.
IRGC Chief General Salami implies the assassination happened days before the U.S. is driven out of the region, a year from the U.S. assassination of General Soleimani in early January this year. Here are a few lines of his statement on the Fakhrizadeh case. Our missiles and drones are locked on 20,000 targets. Only Israel knows who and where we might aim for. The second defense or reaction plan is to destroy thousands of carriers of tanks, planes and equipment. No shot will be aimless and in vain. We warn surrounding countries. Any shot from any point in your countries will be the destruction of the whole area. Israel is a prime suspect, not for no good reason. Israel has the capacity and has done it before. It also has a motive and has the US's blessing, as I said. I asked people from different walks of life how they felt about a prominent Iranian scientist being assassinated on his own soil.
I have a feeling of sadness, anger, and an obligation for me to avenge the blood of this martyr.
I just feel my condolence for such a loss, and I want to express my compassion to my nation. And our society is eager to retaliate. We just want to some retaliation. In the same time, in the same way, at the same level.
We witnessed the cowardly assassination, and I think that the heart of every Iranian and the heart of every free man in the world was saddened. The Iranian people and the whole world condemned such acts.
The available evidence shows the enemies behind this incident were the Americans and the Israelis. We expect the government to fully identify the perpetrators of this assassination and to avenge this martyr.
It's noteworthy the Obama administration condemned Israel's earlier assassinations precisely because it knew the murders wouldn't set back Iran's nuclear program, really, but would set back any efforts to negotiate a deal to curb the program. And now, to get back into that nuclear deal, if Biden wins the US election and takes office, he will most likely have to strongly communicate that Israel will incur costs if it continues to carry out attacks in Iran. The 2015 Iran nuclear deal was signed between Iran and the P5 plus one. That's the US, UK, France, Russia, China, plus Germany.
The nation isn't totally unified in how it views the world, but anti-US sentiment among Iranians still definitely exists and is nothing new. It's not hatred for hatred. It began with US interference in Iran's internal matters even before the revolution. And in the past year alone, the Trump administration has reportedly run several joint sabotage operations with Israel against Iran's nuclear facilities.
Also, to assassinate Iranian General Soleimani outside a Baghdad airport early in January, the US relied partly on Israeli intelligence. And earlier this month, Trump himself reportedly raised the possibility of attacking Iran with his top national security advisors. And shortly after, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Arab adversaries of Iran.
This is how they have failed to overthrow the Islamic Republic for the last 41 years. You know, they thought that having Saddam Hussein attack Iran militarily is going to finish the government here. And what they actually did was to prolong the life of the Islamic Republic by creating so many martyrs. And this is what they don't get. They don't understand that the culture here is a culture of martyrdom, a culture of resistance.
Here's what the people thought about whether the loss of another prominent scientist, perhaps the most prominent of those assassinated, would shatter the foundations of Iran's scientific advancement.
Certainly, the scientists who have been martyred have trained many students to follow in their footsteps. Their blood will definitely help us to continue down this path with more strength.
Removing scientists do not lead to deletion of science, and that is the misperception that they have, and they do know that. It just makes us to pursue knowledge much more than before.
What the enemies and ill wishers of the Islamic Republic should know is that this movement and the progress that has been made during the last 42 years will not be stopped by such events, and we will continue on our path and progress further.
Mr. Ruivaran comments on how the murder might affect the nation.
In terror,
one of its aims was to destroy the morale of the people. As we have seen in the past, society regrets the assassination of its own scientists, and I think this creates a spirit of frustration in society. The security organizations in Iran must act quickly and identify those involved in this crime and respond to them to compensate for the psychological impact on Iranian society.
Apart from the fact that Iran has perhaps hundreds of scientists and institutional knowledge enough to carry on regardless of any single scientist, Mr. Fakhrizadeh's importance is now more symbolic and less for current knowledge of the detail of Iran's present scientific programs.
I believe that knowledge cannot be assassinated. The nuclear or missile knowledge has been localized by Iranian experts. The killing of five other nuclear experts and scientists who were martyred before the signing of the JCPOA did not stop this. The Iranians have gained domestic knowledge that can no longer be stopped.
If it's even possible to excuse Israel's highly probable crime of state terror with the Trump administration's acquiescence, if not complicity, there are those in Israel and the U.S. who see the current maximum pressure policy of U.S. sanctions and threats of attacks on Iran as the only route to stop Iran from expanding its influence, whatever that may mean. The key point is that they think Iran can be controlled by pressure and threats. The five-year history of the JCPOA is enough to prove that theory miserably wrong. The one thing that got Iran to curb its peaceful nuclear program was civility demonstrated in signing that Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or nuclear deal. In return for doing so, nuclear-related economic UN sanctions were to be lifted off Iran. But
they failed to defeat Iran in the fields of hardware and military capabilities, so they opted to focus on the field of software and chaos to eliminate the manifestations of Iran's power, which are its elites and scientists, by the most violent and brutal means, namely terror and assassination. At the same time, while respect for scholars, scientists, and elites has a fundamental place in human nature, for this oppressive order, scientists are perceived as hindrances because they have the knowledge and the enemy knows that they can strengthen their nations.
If partnerships with Israel and Arab states such as Saudi Arabia are to be strategic to the U.S., I'd really reconsider those partnerships, because U.S. strategic partnerships should make the U.S. more secure, not less, to take a page out of responsible statecraft. Plenty more to be learned and more to be said on the matter, and for that I'll be back in no time. But first, a look at other media outlets to see what they have to say with Shahzad.
Hi, I'm Shahrzad Manoucheri, and we'll be reviewing the latest update on the assassination of Iranian scientists and futile attempts to undermine Iran's progress. Tasnim News Agency states ex-CIA head warns of lethal retaliation after assassination of Iranian scientist. Former CIA Director John Brennan described the assassination of top Iranian scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh as a criminal act, warning that this could risk sparking a wider conflagration in the Middle East. This was a criminal act and highly reckless. It risks lethal retaliation and a new round of regional conflict, Brennan tweeted on Friday. Iranian leaders would be wise to wait for the return of responsible American leadership on the global stage and to resist the urge to respond against perceived culprits, he added. In an article by Ruda, we see Bernie Sanders states, assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists, reckless, provocative, and illegal. U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders has described the assassination of a high-ranking Iranian nuclear scientist as reckless, provocative, and illegal, and a deliberate act meant to impair the possible incoming American president's foreign policy agenda. Top Israeli officials have not claimed involvement in the assassination. I have no clue who did it. It's not that my lips are sealed because I'm being responsible. I simply have no clue, Israeli Cabinet Minister Tzachi Hanegbi said. That's all for this segment.
Even after the United States of America tried diplomacy, Israel pressed the Trump administration to end U.S. participation in the JCPOA, and that it did in 2018. This meant U.N. sanctions were now reimposed and reinforced on Iran as U.S. sanctions. Tensions between the two states escalated naturally, and escalation of tensions since have brought the U.S. and Iran to the brink of war twice. Strategic partnership to serve one party. In case you're wondering why the U.S. would serve Israel to the disadvantage of its own people, it wouldn't. It's doubtful it would. But Israel has hold over U.S. presidents thanks to AIPAC, the powerful Jewish lobby in America, and now it has an Arab alliance to support it at this end.
The U.S. government and Israel have a strategic alliance with each other. Sometimes America's behavior goes in the direction that it is willing to suffer a lot of losses in order to save the Zionists. The Zionists, on the other hand, are assisting the Americans in the region. In the U.S. strategy, its hegemonic stability is defined by ensuring Israel's security.
I said some in the U.S., Israel, and its apparently newly allied Arabs accuse Iran of expanding its influence in the region. Iran is a millennia-old regional heavyweight and sees itself responsible for maintaining a balance of power in its own region. Do note, the U.S. is over 10,000 kilometers far from this region, and, well, how Israel came about and maintains its presence in the region. Israel is the decades-long entity that rests on occupied Palestine. Also, it's the only entity in West Asia known to have nuclear warheads, hundreds of them. As for its policy of governmental terrorism, let's take a look at some faces from the past.
2010 saw Massoud Ali Mohammadi, a Tehran University professor, assassinated in a pinpoint blast. Also in late 2010, Majid Shahriari, who specialized in neutron transport, met the same fate. Assassins riding motorcycles planted and detonated a C4 bomb on his car door whilst he was driving. He was instantly killed. Fereydoun Abbasi, his fellow nuclear scientist and professor at Shahid Beheshti University, also had a bomb attached to his car and detonated by the killers from a distance. But he and his wife escaped death. They were wounded. In 2011, Dariush Rezai Nejad was gunned down outside his Tehran apartment. He was an electrical engineer, doctoral student, whose work involved nuclear applications. No time wasted. In 2012 came Mustafa Ahmadi Roshan's turn. Motorbike riders attached a magnetic bomb that tore apart a car carrying him. He was a nuclear scientist working at Iran's main uranium enrichment facility in Natanz. Roshan was in fact set to attend a memorial for Massoud Ali Mohammadi, who was killed in similar fashion. After this latest assassination, it's more likely that should Iran return to the negotiating table, it will return stronger with more demands, not weaker.
Thanks for joining us from the whole team. We'll also be doing a piece on the anniversary of the Soleimani assassination. Bye for now.
IRIB English Radio.